I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A terrific novel that I'm reading now is called Kinmount by Rod Carley, who joins me. It's a funny book that gives the reader an insight into small-town Ontario and their social mores as a down-and-out director from the city arrives to direct an amateur production of Romeo and Juliet. I'll get Rod to tell us as much as he'd like about the book. It shows us what it's like backstage, and it's almost nostalgic, what with these past few months, thanks to COVID. The book also deals with censorship and artistic integrity. I'll ask Rod about that, as he's also an award-winning director, playwright, and actor. He's directed and produced over 100 theatrical productions, including over a dozen adaptations of Shakespeare. In 2009, Rod Carley was the winner of the TVO Big Ideas Best Lecturer competition. He is the artistic director of the Canadore College Acting for Stage and Screen Program, and he's a professor of English at Nipissing University in North Bay, Ontario, where he joined me from last week. Visit rodcarley.ca for more information. This book is from Latitude 46 Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Rod Carley. Mr. Carley, good morning.
Joe, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's nice to talk to you.
Likewise.
Where is Kinmount?
Where is Kinmount? Well, there is the actual village of Kinmount, and it's in eastern Ontario, and what they call sort of highland sort of farm country in the area of Haliburton and Minden. And it's the setting for my new novel, but I make it clear, in the opening of the book, I say, with apologies to the good people of Kinmount. So the Kinmount of the book is the Kinmount that actually exists
right
in Ontario. There's a few facts, right? I chose the title for a comic connotation of a noun followed by a verb.
Mm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the fascinating thing is I'm reading the book because I've never really traveled on. I've been to Pearson twice.
Okay.
That's the only experience I have with Ontario.
Well, that's a journey into itself.
Ontario obviously is a very big place, like mm-hmm. the rest of the country. Kinmount must be 2 hours from Toronto.
Kinmount is about 2.5 hours
okay.
to Toronto. Yeah.
Yeah. So right there is it's a journey, and right there is a sense of it's a different sort of place than some of them are more urban places in this country.
Oh yes, definitely. We're definitely moving into what you call. I think it's varies from region to region across the country, but we're definitely what we move into what we call small town, rural demographics. Right.
Yeah. And it's a different mindset, isn't it?
Very much so. Very much so.
And obviously audiences get different when you go to a different, and not just a different city, but a more country sort of mindset, and so that's a different audience altogether.
Yeah, and I play on that in the book, right? I really exaggerate sort of what that mindset is, for the comedy in the novel too.
Is the Kinmount in the book? Is it, would that be called a theater town, say?
Kinmount? No, it's not a theater town. But what it does have, Joe, which is really kind of fascinating, there's an old movie theater in Kinmount. And it's one of the last of the kind, I think, in Canada. And you look it up. It's called the Highland Cinema.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a mini tourist attraction there where you go in. And I think it seats like maybe, I don't know, 60 people. The old screen, it's the old style coming in. It's got memorabilia going back to the golden age of movies.
Mm.
And it still operates. Of course, it's not operating now due to COVID.
Yeah.
Kimmel's got that. In the book, there is the old mill, which is now an historical site. And there is the burnt river that moves through it. But otherwise, there's not a lot to Kinmount.
And right? I guess what brings people there is, like the movie theater, it's tourism, isn't it? It's a resource city.
Well, you know what? It's cottage country, Joe. And,
right.
Lots of Torontonians have cottages there, and it's surrounded by beautiful lakes. So it really, like a lot of those communities in that area, their population triples in the summer when all the folks in the city comes in, open their cottages up, and they thrive on that economy throughout the summer.
You know, you mentioned the title a moment ago and why you chose that. And I remember reading in the book early on, you know, the reason why you chose that, I guess, what it means. And there are many moments like that make you chuckle or smile broadly or laugh out loud even. What is it like for you to write a book like this? Are you laughing out loud sitting at your desk, say?
Yes, I am, because I have this adage, if it's not fun for the author, it's not going to be fun for the reader. Right?
And it's just awfully clever in some, and I'm trying not to give away some of these moments that I've had, because I think people should read the book for them. It must be awfully satisfying, a process. I mean, writing is obviously hard work. I've talked to authors over the years. A novel can take years, but I mean, in those small moments, say.
The old adage, it goes back to whether it's comedy on stage or comedy in film, and tragedy is easy, comedy's hard.
Yeah.
And I believe that's true. I mean, comedy is serious business. And this novel, it was 5 years from originally outlining it to finishing the final printer's proof. And so in the refinement of it, it's getting, for a funny line to land or a quip to hit or a bit of wit to sit. It's polishing and polishing and refining and cutting. Oh my gosh, cutting! So you finally land, and then it works, right? Because it's all rhythm. It's everything's in the rhythm and the right. So, So when I finally get to a moment where I can laugh out loud, then I know I feel I've arrived, and the image I'm going for or the phrase structure has landed. It's kind of like, because I also work in the theater,
uh-huh.
And I have a rule when I'm directing comedy. The moment we find the laugh first in rehearsal, we get that laugh, we know it's an honest laugh, then from that point on in rehearsal, no one can laugh at it, right? Because we know it works, but now just play it straight and keep it going, right? Because you know it works. There's nothing worse than watching a show where it's all been people laughing because they had all these in-jokes in a rehearsal, and then it falls flat in performance. And I think writing is similar. You know, you've got to, once you've structured and you've got to what that moment of a joke or a quip is, then you move on. But it's getting there. Yeah. So I hope I answered your question.
You did, because now it makes me want to ask you about rhythm. I was going to say, just as I was thinking, listening to you, that there's a rhythm to the writing here. And one would assume that that's from your training in the theater. You're also, Shakespeare plays a part in the book, and so that's probably been inspired by Shakespeare's work as well, right? I mean, it's not an iambic pentameter, but you know what I'm talking about in terms of...
No, I would say a lot of influences in that. And thank you for asking that particular question about rhythm, Joe, in that it's, besides the obvious rules of comedy, there's a three-part setup, and some words are funny and some words aren't funny. It's just how we take them in. But I have been appreciative of great masters of comedy over the years, in terms of American humor, it's Thurber, right? And of course Sedaris now, and Canadian humor, Terry Fallis, who I love the work of Stuart MacLean and whatnot.
Yeah.
And certain actors that had the real rhythm. Well, question back at you. I like Walter Matthau, for example, and I understand you won the Walter Matthau Award in high school. And I was fascinated because I heard, like, so what does one have to do to win the Walter Matthau Award? Because he's, to me, such an incredible example of deadpan humor.
It was from a drama class in grade 12, and she gave out awards, the drama teacher, people that I guess reminded her of certain actors or performers. And so I was at grade 12 already, the curmudgeon in the class.
Well, I'm going to also say that's high praise, because I put Walter Matthau up there, because I mean, I read a great interview with him years ago when he talked about, what he brings to playing comedy is, he played a seriousness, but when it comes to playing the heavier stuff,
yeah,
the lightness. So just anyhow, he was just an interesting kind of reverse shadow and light in everything that he did. And so anyhow, but I had to ask you that question. But yeah, so back to, yeah, so Shakespeare, the rhythm of Shakespeare, I think plays in terms of, I think, because I think Shakespeare invented the three-part setup in many ways.
Right.
In some of his comedy.
Yeah.
And my influence of just, you know, really good classic, you know, I've been listening to an interview with Jerry Seinfeld recently on Q.
Yeah.
And in talking about comedy that endures, like there's comedy right now, like of the moment about the figures in the news, or like, let's say, the a joke. You remember back with Trudeau, the early days of the pandemic, and he garbled his words. And I forget it exactly, but suddenly there was all these memes everywhere about...
Yeah, moistly. Trudeau.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. That's exactly it. And so that kind of, that's funny in the moment.
Right.
But will it be funny in 20 years? So Seinfeld was talking about that. You know, what is comedy? That, and I think he was on to something, is that there are classic elements that make something funny that will make it funny now, will make it funny in 50 years,
yeah.
Or when you're reading older, like when I'm reading like Thurber, going back to stuff he wrote in the 30s, it's hilarious because it follows, you know, right? And I think it's,
yeah.
There's also that sense of what I like is that whole idea of making the trivial incredibly serious, and making the serious incredibly trivial. I mean, Oscar Wilde says it much better than I can, but that idea.
That's the only way to get through life, I guess.
Well, that's why I write with humor. I think,
yeah.
Like, look at us talking right now. Humor is the coin of exchange that we use every day in our lives. Without it, we'd all be jumping off buildings.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's besides the tension relief. For me, I know most things that happen to me, I process through a comic filter, and I think it's my way of coping with pain in the short term. So instead of a way of avoiding life, it's actually a way of me dealing with life. And hence in my writing, I think you can attack serious subjects with humor and have just an important a message to say as if you were writing it in a serious thing, right?
And to this point of rhythm, it's not just the dialogue when the people are talking to one another, where it's quick or it's witty or not even the funny part, where it's clever. It's even in the exposition, if you will, when you describe certain places or
how things
smell, and I mean it brings us to a place in the book where, you know, as I said, I haven't traveled the country. I go to the theater to watch it when one could at the, you know, in olden days, say.
Yes.
But it reminds us of gives us insight, I should say, behind the curtain and what that's like. And that's the fascinating part about, say, Dave Middleton and you know, the how he ends up there.
Mm-hmm. So, because it's the rhythm of sentence structure, which you're talking about, which is me being very conscious of, which is like music, right? You know, music where you go from a Vivace section into an Adante section, and it's all, well, it's all designed, to keep the reader engaged, where you need to change that, and so that if you have a longer structured sentence, you better get a short one in, and it's all about surprising the reader and keeping them on the ride with you, right?
Yeah.
I like to think that every reader that reads my work has ADHD, and that to keep them engaged, you know, I do, right?
To
keep them on the page.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm juggling cats all the time.
No.
But there is an idea that, and I believe that, and I think maybe it's also to Joe, because I have a very low threshold for boredom myself, so I don't want to bore myself when I'm writing.
I mentioned Dave, and what kind of guy is he? I mean, how has he ended up in Kinmount?
Well, Dave, he's a theater director.
Uh-huh.
He's middle-aged, and, you know, there's nothing glamorous about the theater, you know, the real world of most of the arts, right? What you're in for is you got to be committed because you just love it so much that all the other obstacles, you know, you'll cope with them. And Dave's that guy. And finding yourself in Dave's case in his middle 40s, where he's still relying on hand-to-mouth directing jobs and having to take temp jobs between them, mm-hmm. it's a little, you know, it's a little embarrassing. And his mother points it out, you know, that he's still living his life like a college student. But, I mean, that's part of the reality. But so all Dave's got is his artistic integrity, and that's something that I that's very much my viewpoint too. Because for a lot of years, I used to travel around and direct shows all over the province on guest contracts. And what was consistent with everyone is that what I brought with me in my kind of artistic suitcase was my artistic integrity and my ethics of the work. That sometimes that's all you have. So that's what Dave has that. Mm-hmm. So consequently, he has a hard time maintaining relationships because he's on the road all the time. And people would get attracted to Dave because it's so exciting. He's this theater director. But then as they find out more and more what his life is like, that he misses their birthdays, he's mm-hmm. never in town, the allure wears off and Dave usually finds himself up, you know, alone again, naturally, as the song goes. So Dave doesn't have the luxury of picking his directing contracts. So he has to take this directing contract in Kinmount to direct Romeo and Juliet, primarily because he needs the gig, and that's what it comes down to. And so he's a very smart man. Mm-hmm. He is incredibly skilled in what he does.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he has such a self-deprecating stance about himself, is because he has that awareness. And he sees so clearly what's going on. And then, but he also marvels, without giving his spoilers away, yeah. he marvels at the situation he finds himself in, as I think any one of us would, going, how can this actually be happening?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the having a sense of ethics about the work itself and I guess obligation to the author that he has.
Mm-hmm. Very much so, yes.
What is the obligation that the artist has to its audience, say? I mean, at the end of the day, does an audience have a right to see what they want?
Of course they do. They can buy a ticket or not buy a ticket, right? I think that's the democratic nature of the work we do. And I think that's if you don't want to see a certain movie, you don't have to buy a ticket. If you don't want to see a stage play, you don't have to buy a ticket. If you don't want to read that book, right? You don't have to buy the book. So they have a choice right there in terms of whether they go to the event or whatever, or pick up the book or not. But I think as artists, and I can speak of in terms of I'm putting on my directing hat, which is basically just taking my hat I'm wearing right now and turning it backwards. and from a directing point of view, we serve the playwright, and we serve what the playwright has written. And you think about the care that writer has taken to find the right word. They're, you know, just like an author, and the care they've taken and the argument they've come up with and what they've created. So they're entrusting us when we take their work, no matter what level, professional, on the biggest stage in this country or in a small community in the back roads of this country, there is an obligation to serve that writer's theme and message. And myself, like Dave Middleton, there are times you may find yourself in a situation where the playwright is dead, like in the case of Shakespeare, mm-hmm. or they're absent, where you're doing an American writer's work or a Canadian writer's work who, you know, lives across the country. And they're, you know, the only time the playwright's usually in the room with you is if it's a new work,
yeah.
and you're fortunate to be there. So you carry this very heavy responsibility. And so if you do come up against a producer or such, that's saying, you know, I think we got to soften that for the audience. And then my question then is, well, why did you choose the show? Why would you pick that show? Pick the right show for your audience, and don't take a piece that you're then forcing the old square peg in a round hole. Don't do that, because I'm not trying to sound remotely getting on my high horse, because I'm the last person to get on a high horse because I'm allergic to horses, and I'm not in any way trying to sound self-righteous. I'm not. I'm just saying I do believe myself in that kind of integrity about the work, and. I'm proud of the many artists that I've worked with over my career, that I know so many who demonstrate that, and
What are the one of the things that I've noticed in terms of productions of Shakespeare? Sometimes they have to cut for time,
but
in the case of Kinmount, they're cutting for other things. there are other considerations, which is, I guess, the source of some of the conflict in the book. Are these things that you've experienced yourself, say, in your life in the theater?
Yes. Okay. So I want. Yeah. I want. First, I want two things about the book, and then I'll talk about my life. So, in the start of the book, Dave's aware that this is going to be an outdoor summer theater production of Romeo and Juliet, and so he's aware that he's got to cut the play down to a running time that it runs kind of like the length of a summer blockbuster feature, no intermission. So he's got to get it down to 2 hours. So that does apply, the cutting that's pretty standard that we're always doing. And Dave uses the term Shakespearean paleontology, which is a term I also use in my work, where you carefully edit the larger passages down to the core metaphor or image,
yeah,
and trim it down so it works that way. Now, what Dave's facing is, you know, extreme censorship with the play, and I'm not going to, again, I'm going to spoil it, I have had experiences. I'll share one. This is many years back when I was asked to direct a Neil Simon in a summer festival, and it was his play Chapter Two.
Mm.
Now, Neil Simon, we think of as being, you know, The Odd Couple, Walter Matthau again,
yeah,
and all these, you know, like comedies. But Chapter Two was a piece that Neil Simon wrote that dealt with his first wife's death, and then how he met Martha Mason. And so Chapter Two was actually dealing with a man who's grieving and then jumps into a new relationship too soon and gets in this sort of honeymoon ride and then has a meltdown halfway through because he hasn't grieved. And then it turns really dark and it gets really nasty and he leaves her. And then in the end, it resolves itself. And all through that, there is Simon's wit.
Yeah.
The play, I think it did win the Pulitzer Prize. It won a huge award for Simon back when it came out because it was a real... different path for him.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I was doing the show, and the producer was saying, "Rob, this isn't funny. This isn't funny." I said, "Look at the writing of the scene. It says right here he hits her, so it's in the writing." And I'm not endorsing anyone hitting anyone, of course not. But in the writing of the play, it got to that level of emotional relief and anger and rage and hurt that was in the scene. And so this producer wanted me to tone all that down and said, "Just keep it's the jokes." And I said, "Well, if you wanted just the jokes, why didn't you do it?" And I said, first off, even Neil Simon, it's not just the jokes. He's telling stories of what it is to be human.
Yeah.
And you don't play the jokes. The jokes are in the reality of the situation. Besides that fact, I said, I think you chose the wrong show.
Mm.
And it's the same way with this particular festival in Kinmount, where they for what they think they want, they really chose the wrong show.
Yeah. The other thing, as I said, as I'm reading the book, you take us behind the scenes. You lift the curtain as to, I mean, it's awfully hard work to put on a show, awfully hard work to work in the theater. But at the same time, it shows us the importance of the theater, even in a small community like Kinmount, mm-hmm. How much it's a part of the life, say. And in these times, I'm sure you encounter a lot of people who are aching for it.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, yes. Well, you know, a couple of things. First off, for those that work in it, I've always thought you form this sort of very brief and close dysfunctional family. You come together, yeah, you know, for a rehearsal period, you do a show, and you get so close. And I always say it's where misfits fit. You know, you get actors off the streets for a little while, and they come into this sort of safe house to do a show.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect, but there's also on the bigger level. And again, this is where theater, like good literature, right? I see a good play. I read a great piece of writing. It's informing me of what it does it mean to be human.
Mm.
And if it's done its job, I feel less alone. I feel more connected. And I do believe in the arts of all levels, they serve for the psychic well-being of a community. And with what we're seeing right now, I have so many colleagues right now that are out of work and not knowing when they will be working again. And I myself, on the other side of my life, my theater side, I had a number of projects that have been canceled, originally delayed and now canceled.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when I wrote Kinmount, Joe, I was, you know, I knew I wanted to tell this comic story of a director who comes up against this sort of rural band of furies and is fighting against censorship. And it would be a tale about you know, how will he prevail or not? So I knew that. But what I then I realized more as I was writing it was that I was kind of writing a tattered love letter to Canadian theater. And now in the wake of COVID, with all of us aching to do theater, I see now in the book that if you read the book, you see why we go to the theater, why actors get together and collaborate to create this kind of art form. And I'm hoping that maybe it can help fill in the gap a little bit for people while we wait to see theaters back on the stage. And I did have one reviewer on Goodreads sort of allude to that fact that, you know, in terms of the crucial need for theater, that need for the audience actor communion. I always say that whenever you have a room, it could be with an author reading at a reader series or it's a play with an audience, wherever you have words being spoken that are truth and you have an audience and you have a reader or actor, they're sharing and breathing the same air, right? Something magical is going to come out of that. And it is. It's a kind of it's a sacred communion of creation. And I believe that fully. And we haven't been able to do that recently. So I'm hoping that Kinmount can tide people over a little bit.
Yeah, it's almost nostalgic to read the book in some parts.
Isn't it, and it's only like, because it's been, what, 8 months, but sometimes it feels like it's...
It's a different life,
I mean, how are you doing? How are you finding yourself in the middle of, you know, 8 months into COVID right now yourself?
There are a lot of people who are hurting, and so I'm very grateful that I'm coping well, and that I'm living comfortably. And I, you know, you do feel for a lot of people, this is for, you know, not just in wherever one lives, but all over the place who, haven't been able to make it that's the thing that it's shown us, I think, these past few months about how, precarious life was for people day to day, even, you know, paycheck to paycheck and the sort. So. You know, I'm grateful for where I am and that I'm, you know, I'm doing well. But it breaks your heart, you know, to realize that, you know, something like this, you know, they keep saying that it's brought us together. And I think it has in some ways, but I think it's also, you know, shown us where, you know, there's great inequity in life.
And maybe we're seeing some government policy
begin
to reflect some of that change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure we're in the same court that way. Let's go further with it. Let's see, are we going to get, you know, a basic guaranteed annual income? Where is it going to move? Yeah. Where it needs to move, right? I mean, we need to get the spirit of Tommy Douglas in here.
Yeah, because I think that's, I mean, you know, they say this is not the last pandemic. And, you know, looking at history, I mean, it's things like this are only going to happen more often, say.
You know, and it's funny you say history, because I know for me a little bit, it's actually in history where I've found a little bit of comfort. I mean, in terms of, Shakespeare, you know, the plague shutting things down for a year, and then everyone buggers off to the north, or he buggers off back to Stratford, and they write, and they try to get through. You know, in London, when we think of, like, as we're shutting things down, and whether people talk to stage two or back to stage one or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And in Shakespeare's day, they had it with a plague death count. So if the plague death count, right, was 50 or less in a day in London, then the play went up.
Mm.
But if you went over 50, then you couldn't perform. So we look at that extreme compared to now, you know, and I'm kind of glad we're not sitting at 50 deaths a day. It means that you can still, you know, there is a kind of parallel. But the other thing I've thought about is a bit, you know, and you and I, we're of the same age, we're the same generation, and we, in some ways, I thought, in some ways, and I mean this very generally, but in some ways, we have kind of dodged a bullet in some ways, in that we've never had to be through two world wars. We never had to go through the Great Depression, like my grandparents, my parents even. We never had to battle the Spanish influenza and other, you know, and I'm not saying it's our due. I'm not saying that we deserve this in any way.
No.
But I am saying there's something about this that is testing the mettle of humanity right now, and what we're going to do with it. And so from that level, because I am a person that ultimately believes in hope, and the betterment of humanity, and that we're good, we're decent.
Indeed.
That we're overall decent, right?
Yeah.
So I want, and maybe this is, you know, and what a way to do it, but sometimes it's the only way, right? It's like when your engine light goes on in your car, finally you're going to go in and get it fixed.
Mm.
And it's like COVID is this giant engine light going off for the world on all levels going, we got to fix this. We got to re-figure out how this whole engine works of life.
You mentioned Shakespeare a moment ago, and he had, his work has been important in your life. I never liked it growing up as a kid because it was.
I can tell you, I didn't like him in high school.
So yeah.
I didn't work for me in high school. I got inspired. I went to York University in the early '80s, and I met a man named Neil Freeman in my third year.
Mm.
And it was Neil, and I acknowledge him in my book and my acknowledgments. And Neil Freeman was just beginning in the early '80s. To explore the original first folio of Shakespeare, the original scripts, to see what clues might be there in the original punctuation and grammar and such, right? Because originally, it's called orthography, the way you put, the way you write words on a paper.
Yeah.
And originally, none of these scripts were done for like bedside reading. They were all clues to emotional release and how a character's thinking and the stepping stones to their argument. So they were clues to kind of like doing a Sunday Night Live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In a week, you come together and you produce this. In Shakespeare's case, you got 2 weeks, so lots of shorthand. And so these were all designed as after clues. And then they all got eradicated in the early 1700s with the Statute of Grammar, when everything got sort of universalized, and then grammar and the use of capital letters, spellings, mm-hmm. all became indicative of a proper use for reading and not performing. So he turned me on in a way where his enthusiasm, I became like the Watson to his home in some ways, and sort of developed this fascination for language and going into the details. And go, oh my God, isn't it amazing how an entire character's emotional being can shift on this vowel or this extended spelling, or how this little piece of punctuation could change the entire world of this worldview of a character. And again, it stuck with me. And so that aspect where Dave Middleton in the book says, you know, that he is in the first folio of Stalwart Droid, right? Well, I think in some ways I had that experience at York where Neil Freeman was my kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi and I was his Luke Skywalker. But I say that by saying that up until that point, it didn't connect with me in high school, and I think a lot of it is because, and no fault of their own, but I don't think a lot of teachers dread teaching it,
and they
don't bring it alive in a way that their students want to engage, and I think ironically like AA was created by two individuals that were formerly alcoholics,
right?
Makes sense that they created it. It's kind of like. It's like why you would hire a bank robber to do your bank security, because they know how it works.
Mm.
So to me, it was like because I struggled with Shakespeare in high school, and then it was opened up to me in a new way, I was even that much more excited and passionate about it because I had been on the other of it, and now I got a way into saying, aha, now I see how this works. If they can get someone like me engaged in a way, then it must be working, because before I wouldn't have been that individual.
Yeah. And when you were talking a moment ago about what his experience was like during the plague, it shows us just how, you know, even though it's hundreds of years old, this material, how it can be relevant generation after generation.
Oh, entirely. And I think, because that question's often asked, right? You know, like right now, school boards across the country are talking about they're reducing Shakespeare in the curriculum.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other podcast talking about that. But
right.
And so I ask, why are we still doing this dead writer's work, you know, who's been dead now for, you know, 4 years now?
Uh-huh.
Why? And it's because I believe of his penetrating insights about human behavior.
Yeah.
And that still holds up. And you know, yes, he may struggle with the language, but when you get inside what he's saying, I think, you know, he was always about his masculine, his men are trying to find the feminine inside themselves, and his female characters are trying to find the masculine inside themselves, and he was really ahead of his time.
Mm.
And, yes, so I think that's why he's still the most produced English-speaking playwright in the world. But I believe as we move into discussions, of, you know, as we're talking about with curriculum, and
yeah.
Yes, and it's great to see that we're putting more Indigenous writers that are getting in there, and more writers from all different ethnicities on writing, but keep Shakespeare, but keep it in the context with these other writers.
Yeah.
And there's a way, because, you know, everything cross-pollinates, Joe.
Right.
Everything's relatable. It's just how, and that's where it works, because it's the whole idea of, you know, history, you know, if we don't remember it, we're doomed to repeat it. And I know we've all heard that old bromide many times.
Yeah.
But it's because it's true.
Yeah.
It's so true.
I can't tell you how much fun this has been to talk to you about your book.
Oh, Joe, I'm thoroughly enjoying talking with you, yes.
And I cannot wait to finish it, because, as I told you, I am enjoying it a great deal. You have this great gift of writing, not only for the eye, but for the ear. I don't know if people understand you know what that means in terms of...
Well, again, if I may, before we go, you said writing for the ear, right?
Yeah.
Well, in Shakespeare's day, they didn't say, we're going to go see a play. They said, we're going to go hear a play.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
And in his era, you know, we're a visual society, right?
Sure.
So you and I, let's say we go to see, and I'm not a huge fan of them, but, you know, we go to see the latest, you know, action Marvel movie, right?
Yeah.
And we're used to watching maybe, you know, 45 fast edits visually in a minute, and we don't get a headache. In Shakespeare's day, because they went to hear, they were used to hearing maybe like 25 to 30 puns and word hits in a minute, right? So that when you share that about the book, hearing the book, I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think that's where that all comes from.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
On that level. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, no, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for your time today, and continued good luck with the book. As I said, I'm enjoying it a great deal, and I've enjoyed our time today.
Oh, I certainly had a great time with you, Joe, and you take care, and all the best.
The book is called Kinmount. It's from Latitude 46 Publishing. Visit rodcarley.ca for more information. Rod Carley joined me on the line from North Bay, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.